Next on Making Sense of the Madness, energy is up 5,000% in the UK. Biden is trying to convince Americans that gas is cheap now, and there's no recession at all. The black community is awakening to their exploitation by progressive elites as political pawns, and we're going to question the mainstream narrative and expose media propaganda right now.
Talk about a possible recession and the technical definition of what it means. Let's forget that and just get practical. Explain to us the health of our economy right now.
Well, we're in a transition, and it feels unique because it is unique. At the same time, we are seeing things slow, as you would expect in this context. But the key thing right now is that as we are in this transition, the choices we make now, the policy choices we make now, whether we actually take more action to lower prices and make things more affordable for families, these will help determine how successful we are at actually making that transition.
That's right. It's a transition. It's not a recession. And as long as we don't call it a recession, Americans will think our economy's growing. You know, you've got to be some really genius propagandists in that Biden regime. Well, a staff of 70 people created this recent social media post with a misspelling that tried to prove to Americans that they are actually saving money on gas, despite the fact that under Biden, they've had record increase in gas prices. This is called gaslighting. Well, you may be able to fool some Americans some of the time, but the price of gas is not one of those things that you can trick them on. Nice try, Biden. Well, Dr. Kirk Elliott is a PhD economist and founder of Kirk Elliott Private Advisors. He's always researching the latest trends in finance and geopolitics. Kirk, I saw the price of energy in the UK went up 5,000% briefly amidst their heat wave. How much do you analyze these energy prices, these shocks and so forth, when you're looking at the whole finance macro environment?
Well, you have to look at it big because energy is a large part of our life, right? It's not just gas at the gas pumps. It's not just air conditioning and heating to cool or warm our house, right? It's every factory on the planet uses energy to build things, right? So when you've got the wholesale price level with energy prices going up that high, it means the inflationary pressures that we're seeing are just the tip of the iceberg. And they're going to continue going up, not just because of energy prices going up, but we have still supply chain disruptions. We have inflation across the board in every country on earth, which is causing massive, massive quantitative tightening, right? They're tightening credit. So because they have to raise rates to slow down this inflation. Well, this is a problem for the bond market. Huge problem. So this is how energy prices, as part of inflation, is going to impact everything else that we do, including things like China dumping U.S. treasuries to the tune of, we now have less than a trillion. They have less than $1 trillion of U.S. treasuries. First time since 2010, they dipped below that number. But it's not just U.S. treasuries that they're dumping. They're dumping Japanese treasuries. They're dumping European Union treasuries. Because as interest rates go up, the value of bonds comes down. That's true for consumers. That's also true for countries, you know, that are buying treasuries from those countries, because nobody holds a treasury, a 30-year bond, until maturity. They always sell it before that. So if rates go up, the value of those bonds or treasuries comes down. And if they wait till later to sell them, well, then they're going to shoot themselves in the foot. So here's where all of these treasuries are, as part of inflation, they have to raise rates to slow down that inflation. When they do that, it devalues the bonds. Countries get rid of them. Now there's less money, and you have to keep printing an inflate or die scenario. So everything is interrelated, John. It's all connected.
Right. You know, what I'm hearing from you here is that once one bad thing happens, you know, like tightening, tightening the credits. Then you've got other bad things that happen, like the energy goes up and the corporate profits go down and so forth. And then you just end up in one of these economic cycles. Some people call it a recession or a depression. Now people are calling it a transition for some reason. Isn't it better for us to just admit where we're at financially so we can solve the problem?
Well, we have to. Janet Yellen might be the most incompetent person on the planet when it comes to the economy. I mean, she's changing what a recession actually is by her language, right? But so is everybody that was actually a cheerleader for Biden early on, right? So Janet Yellen, she said, well, this is not an economy that is in recession, but we're in a period of transition in which growth is slowing. It's like, all right, stop softening it. It's a recession. A recession is two quarters in a row of declining economic productivity, right? Well, we've had more than that. We've had this, since mid-COVID, right? Everything. So that technically puts us in a depression. I wonder what she would call that. If a recession is a period of transition in which growth is slowing, what is she going to say when we actually are in a depression, right? She's going to say, well, we're in a transition in which growth has stopped, right? I mean, unbelievable. I mean, so economist after economist is now starting to jump ship. Even Krugman, even Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winner, issued his big fat apology in a week. So he said, I was wrong about inflation. This was a lesson in humility. It's like, how, when you're that smart and you win a Nobel Prize, how could you be wrong? You know what causes inflation. It's increasing money supply. But yet, here's the problem, Sean, is all these economists that are politically motivated have to pass the political test and support the guy in charge. And when they're wrong, now their whole reputation is at risk. And that's what we're starting to see.
I think that's how you win the Nobel Prize to begin with, is getting that political approval. But that whole idea of calling inflation transitory when it was obviously not just transitory was another one of those spin games that they did with words and language that actually, we didn't fall for. We knew what they were talking. We knew what they were trying to do. They're trying to put lipstick on a pig like they always do. But tell us how this affects, our investments, our 401ks, our retirement funds, and of course, people who are interested in hedging this inflation.
Well, rising prices is going to cause people to spend less, right? Because they're just going to have less money at the end of every month. They're basically having to curtail their spending just so they can survive. Well, that'll put a negative impact on stocks, bonds, mutual funds, right? Because they're spending less. So the stock market's going to continue to come down. Bond market will continue to come down as interest rates rise. But gold and silver go up. This is what I've been shouting from the rooftops for a year on your show, right? Is when you're in times of inflation and in a time where the economy is slowing, but yet prices are going up, this is going to have a major dramatic negative impact on traditional markets like stocks, bonds, mutual funds, real estate, but an amazing impact because it's the same forces that cause stocks and bonds to come down, cause gold and silver to go up. So you want to protect yourself, inoculate yourself from these inflationary pressures, go into gold and silver, especially silver, because you've got other factors at play in a post-COVID world of supply chain disruptions, low inventory, high demand, and a lot of manufacturing demand because silver is used in all forms of electronics. This is how you navigate through this transition, right? Is by gobbling up and investing in silver and gold, which respond very well to inflationary pressures.
Yeah, this really does seem like a repeat of the 1970s, and people who had gold and silver back then did very well. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Kirk Elliott from Kirk Elliott Private Advisors. Next up, we're talking to author Adam B. Coleman, who'll give us his commentary on the Black community going from victimhood to victory as soon as we get back.
Government-induced inflation, taxes, rising interest rates, political instability. All of these can have a crushing effect on our investments, often causing the stock market to go down. But they can also cause gold and silver to go up.
Hi, this is Dr. Kirk Elliott. Buy gold, buy silver, buy now, but buyer beware. Precious metals companies are not created equal. As a PhD economist, I have been in the financial, economic, and precious metals business for 3 decades. The philosophy of my firm is people over profit. I encourage you to read my bio to learn more about me at KirkElliottPhD.com.
Now is the time to own physical metals in an IRA, 401k, and outside of a retirement plan. Don't let the government destroy your hard-earned assets any longer. Call 720-605-3900 or visit KirkElliottPhD.com.
Hypocrisy put on blast. The New York Post op-ed is calling out politicians pushing to defund the police after they move to safer neighborhoods. Our next guest writes, quote, "When you advocate for police positions that hurt the people you left behind, who can't just up and leave their homes on a whim, well, there's a special circle of hell." Adam Coleman is the author of that piece and this book, Black Victim to Black Victor, joins us now. Adam, your response and your editorial, really based on what I saw in the cover of the New York Post earlier, you're outraged.
Yeah, very much so. And to be honest with you, her actions aren't new. This is the type of hypocrisy that a lot of progressive politicians and progressive urbanites in general are behaving like. They move into these areas that are up and coming, and then when all of a sudden things go sideways, they take their money, they leave, which is fine. If you're in danger, I have no problem with you leaving a particular area. But my problem comes when you advocate for policies that would hurt the very people that you were neighbors with.
And when you talk about...
That was Adam B. Coleman. He is the author of Black Victim to Black Victor. Adam, do you think there's been a political awakening happening within the black community since George Floyd and the BLM riots?
I believe so. I think it's taken a little bit, but there are more people like myself who, so your audience understands, I'm a former Democrat, who have taken a look at their political party and started to question their actions, their advocacies, and their principles. This is not a liberal party or of true liberal principles that I used to believe, which has forced me basically to become an independent. And I think there are a lot of people, whether it's black or any other race, but including black people, they're starting to question exactly what are they advocating for? Maybe even the promise that are made to them every 4 years that never come to fruition. You know, these are the type of questions that a lot of black Americans are asking themselves. And especially when it comes to Black Lives Matter, and as time has gone on, we're looking to see what exactly have they done as an organization and why were they propped up by corporate America? We're starting to see their financials come through from last year, the tens of millions of dollars that they're basically hoarding. They have no idea what to do with. And even in some cases, spending it in, I don't want to say reckless manner, but it seems like self-serving manner. I think a lot of people are waking up.
Yes, I agree with you there. I want to read a quote from your website. You said, "Black Americans are constantly lied to about the source of their community's issues in an effort to profit off their pain and to make sure that they never leave the mindset of the victim in order to move forward in American society. Black people must be critical of all sectors of Black culture and the people that profit off the mainstream Black victim messaging." Can you give us some examples of who you think is profiting off of Black victim messaging?
Funny enough, other black people, especially the black elite, I have an entire chapter talking about the ivory tower black elite that exists within America. I wrote a New York Post op-ed talking about Jonathan Capehart, who wrote this entire piece displaying how black people are basically scared and fearful and weak, even down to the point of thinking about leaving this country as an option. Meanwhile, he lives in Washington, D.C., I would imagine very comfortably, and he's not really going anywhere. So it's very profitable to paint black people in a particular light of being fearful. It's not nearly as profitable to say that they're capable. And so what I wanted to do, especially with that op-ed, you know, they're able to say that Larry Elder is the black face of white supremacy. I wanted to redefine white supremacy and put a black face to it, just like how they did towards Larry Elder by saying that Jonathan Capehart, amongst other black elite, are the black faces of white supremacy. They're the people who want to basically degrade other black people and always show them in a negative light, especially as far as being incapable, and especially being incapable unless someone interferes, including the government. So I wanted to, use the left's words, use their phrases against them. But I think that there's a lot of people, ultimately, not just the black elite, the media, politicians, especially left-wing politicians. I think everybody finds this as convenient political footballs. They can just throw from one topic to another, one policy to another, to get people to operate off of guilt, historical guilt, and get them to move in a way that doesn't make any sense outside of that. So I've been saying for especially the past 2 to 3 years, if you want something to happen within DC, if you want something to happen culturally, just say it benefits black people. That's all you really have to do.
Well, you actually wrote a piece about how black people are being used as an experiment for communism. And what you were just describing, where you're trying to keep a community divided and have these different class struggles and so forth, sounds like a communist playbook. Can you describe that?
Yeah. The whole idea about defunding the police, for example, we know who it's primarily going to affect. It's going to affect, obviously, black people, but it's also going to affect people who are in higher crime-ridden areas first. It's just that it's going to disproportionately affect black Americans the most. Getting rid of the police, ultimately, it's about having it's one of the first steps to having a society that doesn't punish for our current social norms, our current social standards. So it's just the beginning steps. You have prison reform, you have bail reform. You see countless examples of people who commit crimes going into jail and coming right out. You have progressive, I would even say in some cases, communistic district attorneys who drop charges of criminals. The purpose of everything is to demoralize the system. You look at New York City, they have record numbers of police officers who are either quitting or retiring. They're not able to recruit. We're entering a stage of demoralization in a lot of cities throughout our country. I believe Chicago's going through a similar situation, probably in San Francisco as well. This is a great experiment that's being used on Black Americans, or I should say that's going to disproportionately affect Black Americans. So we're seeing what it's going to turn into, this Marxist communistic viewpoint of society. And so, yeah, we're going to be the experiments because we're going to be the ones that are going to be largely impacted. If you're just talking about a particular demographic. So policing, we already know about the welfare state in some respects, you know, the dependency on the state to take care of you, the continual advocacy, running to the federal government, you know, big government to do something for us. You can see it. You can see how government is a constant within our lives, or at least trying to have it forced down our throats in order to have any sort of so-called progress. Not capitalism, not independence, and not even family. The idea of having family, the nuclear family, is in opposition to the communist worldview. The family is the state. So if we can separate the family, the state can grab everybody else, including your children. And so when we have the highest rate of single parenthood, and it's increasing throughout the country of all demographics, I think we're heading towards that. We're heading towards a societal demoralization, a family demoralization. I'm very cautious of it. I don't want to say afraid. I'm very cautious of the direction that we're going. And I thought that's one of the reasons why I decided to speak up and write as often as I do.
Well, it isn't exactly a hidden agenda, because Black Lives Matter has it directly in their description of their mission, that they want to disrupt the nuclear family. So that's very brazen of them to do, especially like you said, Black community has this disproportionate effects of a single parenthood. We're going to talk more about that. I also want to get your perspective on leftists calling Justice Clarence Thomas and Uncle Tom as soon as we get back.
Inflation is out of control. The price of gasoline has doubled in a very short time, and interest rates are set to rise. How do you protect and grow your portfolio to make sure that you do not outlive your assets? Invest in annuities that have rate lock. Rate lock is an innovative new feature that allows you to lock in your rate of return at any time during the year to lock in these volatile upswings of the market. And unlike CDs and money market accounts, they accumulate tax deferred and can participate in the upside of market indexes. And they're probate free, and they can provide an income that you can't outlive. With all the different companies, features, indexes, and benefits which annuities offer, it can be confusing to choose which annuity is best for your unique situation. Let a company you can trust help you select a rate lock annuity that's right for you. Add an annuity to your retirement portfolio and start enjoying the many benefits that smart investors love. Call the Cleveland Insurance Group at 844-USA-2024. That's the Cleveland Insurance Group at 844-USA-2024. The Cleveland Insurance Group, 844-USA-2024.
He's the author of Black Victim to Black Victor. Adam, you recently wrote a piece about leftists calling Justice Clarence Thomas and Uncle Tom. Can you tell me, it seems like the mask is slipping as far as who the real racists are, when race is constantly invoked whenever a Black person says or does something that goes against the leftist narrative. Can you speak on that particular issue of Justice Clarence Thomas?
Yeah, absolutely. I personally went on a little bit of a tear on Twitter, highlighting all the examples of, you know, regular people and even prominent people who were saying outright racist things, calling him the N-word, calling him Uncle Tom, Coon, you name it. The reason I did that and I took such an opportunity to write about it, even in the New York Post, is because it's not too often that people actually care. And it's not too often that people actually see it firsthand. I know about it because I've examined it. And there are small situations of prominent people, you know, every so often, but it's not large enough for where people care, or even pay attention to what's going on. I wrote an entire chapter talking basically about how you can call a Black conservative or Republican anything that you want. You can insult them, you can use racial slurs, and still try to appear as the good guy during the process. No one ever loses their job. You can say it on MSNBC, you can say it on mainstream TV, you could be a politician, media figure. It really doesn't matter. Average person, you'll never lose your job. Nothing will happen to you. And that's the reality. And that's an unfair thing, even if you don't agree with Clarence Thomas. And I wanted to make those articles about the act rather than about Clarence Thomas himself. Clarence doesn't need me to defend him. I'm nobody. But it's the act. You know, if we're claiming that we're trying to be an anti-racist society, but then you say, well, in some situations we can use, you know, racial slurs and, you know, because, oh, it's this person. Right. And that's not being principled. And so I wanted to highlight that within the piece about how on the left, especially, they are not principled when it comes to race, racism. A matter of fact, in my opinion, I think progressives project the racism and they have much of a savior mentality when it comes to Black Americans. And they merely just put up with us, utilize us. And if we step out of line, they call us out. And they call us whatever they want. So as long as you don't step over that ideological line, you'll be fine. But when you do, if you're someone like Clarence Thomas, who votes in the way that people don't think is suitable for a Black man, or as I like to say, if you're Blacking wrong, you'll get called a coon. You'll get called the N-word. You'll get called anything that they deem necessary to get you back in line, or if you stay out of line, to keep you maligned. So I wanted to shine a light on that. And I think with Roe v. Wade and it being a figure like Clarence Thomas, and how it wasn't actually just his decision. It was multiple people's decision. Yet he's the one who's receiving the primary overwhelming criticism and hatred. And so now I got to say, here's why. I've known for a while that progressives are racist, but we throw the word racist around too often. But here I have an example. They're outright saying it. This is how they really feel. And I wanted to say that the veil has been lifted. This is who they are.
It reminds me when Joe Biden said, you know, if you don't vote for me, you ain't black. It's almost as if if you don't stay within that box, then your black identity is challenged. And you also wrote a piece recently about how Kamala Harris could be a diversity hire. That's pretty brave to do in today's hostile environment, because like you said, you can challenge, you know, black conservatives, but you don't dare do it to a leftist. So tell me about the points that you think could prove that she's a diversity hire and not the vice president of the United States, because she's one of the most capable people in our country.
Yeah, I mean, it's always funny writing for publications because you never know what title they're going to go with. But they said, you know, Kamala Harris is a diversity hire. I mean, my article was proving the point that she is by definition. When Joe Biden was set to be the nominee, they were asking who he's going to pick. And he said, I'm looking for a black female, right? Or a woman of color, right? He kept saying those words, which means at the forefront, that's what he is looking for. He is looking for someone of diversity. It wasn't a situation where there's a list of people of different demographics, or even let's say it was all black women, but he didn't even outright say that he was looking for a diversity hire, even though we could assume it. He purposely said it because he wanted people to know this is what I'm looking for. He is looking for diversity first. And so now here we have Kamala Harris, who in many ways, if isn't incompetent, sounds incompetent, unhelpful, not popular. Even Democrats didn't like her. Tulsi Gabbard lasted longer than, you know, Kamala Harris running for presidency. Why did he pick her? You know, she is probably one of the last people you'd want to pick, but she fits the criteria. And on top of that, she's an establishment person. She'll do anything for power. I learned that she will even sell out her own family or aspects of her own people just to get ahead. I don't know if people are even aware of this, but she went on Hot 97 and speaking there and talking about how she smoked weed before. And she's like, you know, I'm Jamaican, right? And her father actually spoke out against that. Like, what are you talking about? And don't ever sell this out like that for some TV show so you can get a couple of votes, or at least assume you get some votes. She's the type of person you never want to have power, and they gave her power. She is a diversity hire by definition, because he announced the diversity of the candidate first as being his primary reasoning for picking someone, and Kamala Harris ended up being that person.
That makes sense to me. And it's also especially hypocritical that while she's bragging about smoking weed in the past, she would put people behind bars for those types of nonviolent crimes while she was, attorney general in California. So you talked about critical race theory advocates are one of those groups, entities that are profiting off of this black victimhood messaging. What do you mean by they are profiting? Do you mean power, or do you mean actual dollars and cents?
All the above. I think the most prominent are basically Marxists. You can say they're neo-Marxists or whatever you want to call them, but they believe in Marxist concepts, everything that they say. The people that they admire from years ago, they're Marxists. They're self-avowed Marxists. I think we should call them what they actually are and not just pretend that these are just anti-racists or the soft language that they'd like to go by now, because Marxist sounds too harsh and inflammatory. But I think these people are neo-Marxists. They have a particular agenda. Everything is about a division. It's about creating a dichotomy, no matter what it is. So within one group, they're going to segment that group And within those groups that they segmented, they're going to have more subgroups and more subgroups. And all it does is create more division within whatever society that you have. So even the gaslighting of critical race theory by saying, well, we're not really teaching critical race theory. They're putting it into practice. It's a praxis form of critical race theory. It's not the legal form. That's the gaslighting part. That's what they're trying to hide and conceal. But the results are what they are. They're going to infuse race into science, into math. Why? Why is that the case? It's not just them trying to attempt to talk about history. And in many cases, when they talk about history, it's from a very biased stance. And, you know, devil's advocate, there's bias in everything, but it's very obvious what they're trying to do. They're trying to set up a society where people of color, and personally, I hate using that term, but that's the term that people use now, but people of color are different than white people. They're trying to have a world where we see race as a division. And notice, they rarely bring up a class division unless it's convenient. I think there is a class element when it comes to the people who are the anti-racists, who are the followers of this. I call it a boutique philosophy, a boutique religion of the anti-racist movement. I've noticed that they're typically wealthy, they're typically highly educated, and actually, regardless of race, they're Black, white, there's Hispanic, they're typically of a particular class, and they're in prominent positions. They're within our schools because they went to these liberal art colleges, and most people don't go to college. So they're part of a small percentage of people, relatively speaking, who go to college, who come out, and now they get to teach your children how to be an anti-racist, how to teach your child to be a neo-Marxist, right? And conceal these things, how to become gender fluid, and basically everything that is antithetical to the America that I grew up in. Even 10 years ago. So I think that is something that everybody should be concerned with, including Black Americans.
Thank you for your commentary on that. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to get your thoughts on people using Black Americans to cancel Joe Rogan, most popular podcaster in the world, as soon as we get back.
Hydrogen is used by health professionals as a powerful antioxidant and the number one tool to fight inflammation. Studies show therapeutic potential in cancer, diabetes, digestive, and heart issues, and essentially every organ and system in the body. This is not medical advice because I'm not your doctor, but if you have any health concerns, I strongly recommend that you learn more about hydrogen. Get educated at holyhydrogen.com and order the best hydrogen generator known to man. Because hydrogen is the smallest molecule in existence, it can pass through the cell membrane and even the blood-brain barrier to clear out inflammation and free radical damage where other antioxidants just can't get to. Visit holyhydrogen.com to see the latest technology that elevates your immune system and fights inflammation. Search their research library to see if hydrogen has a track record for helping a health concern you're dealing with. Make sure to use your special American Media Periscope code, AMP, for $100 off your order. HolyHydrogen.com.
We're talking to Adam B. Coleman. So recently, people tried to cancel Joe Rogan. Apparently, he used the N-word, not in a context that was disparaging to Black people, but nevertheless, he used the N-word. And I think people wanted to cancel him anyway for other reasons. You know, he was talking about COVID, questioning the medical tyranny, and it wasn't very convenient to have Joe Rogan around anymore. And you wrote a piece about how you don't think people should use Black Americans to cancel Joe Rogan. Why is that?
Because this isn't our fight. This was, like you said, at the time when that media hit video came out, he had controversial figures. I say controversial. I don't think they were controversial. But, you know, Dr. Malone and other figures who were providing information regarding COVID, regarding the vaccines and things of that nature. And there was an outright attack on him because he was willing to sit down and have conversations with these people, and especially being the largest podcast in the world. And so, yeah, there was an attack on him for, quote unquote, misinformation, but even more so going against establishment narrative and the censorship that was happening at the time. And so what's an easy way to try and get rid of them? Just like I was saying before, if you want to say that, if you want some sort of policy or you want some sort of social change, just say it benefits Black people, but also say it hurts Black people too, right? So let's find something that we can use that's inflammatory. And that's when they made this compilation of him saying the N-word, which the N-word by itself is not, it's just a word, especially if you're talking about it in context of it being a bad thing. That is kind of the trick that they were trying to take advantage of. And that's the misleading thing. As someone who's listened to Joe Rogan for, I don't know how many hours, he's not the guy, you know, he's not the guy to go after. He's a very polite, conscious person who speaks to anybody and everybody, who doesn't really care, who's friends with all different types of people, and kind of a hippie, you know, so to speak, where he's just about free love and taking DMT. This guy is not worried about being a racist or finding a reason to hate people. He's actually trying to do the opposite. So I just saw it as more of invoking fear or invoking pain of Black people or offense for Black people or whatever you want to call it. But ultimately, this isn't our fight. And we shouldn't waste emotional energy on someone utilizing this word that within context was not meant to be offensive towards us, but now is being used to target and try to cancel Joe Rogan, so to speak. But he's not cancelable, in my opinion.
They tried, it didn't work, but you know, that is the tactic. And it reminds me of, we were talking about critical race theory. If anyone comes out against critical race theory, whether they're white or Black or whatever, they're labeled as racist, right? It's that tactic to label whoever disagrees with that leftist narrative is supposedly a racist. But you know, it's been tried so many times, and now it's people are getting fatigue on labeling others as racist, and it's not working. It's not as powerful as it used to be. I want to switch gears and talk about groomers and predators and about fatherhood. You've been written a lot about this, and it's important to the Black community. Maybe you can tell me why.
Yeah. You know, the primary arguments that I'm making within my book is that family is extremely important. You know, I try to highlight that is the number one issue regarding Black Americans, but it's actually becoming an American issue, or actually it is an American issue. America has the highest rate of single parent homes in the world. And this is something that we should all be very concerned with as to why this is happening. And what are the effects of raising children in single parent homes? So as a Black American, when I'm looking around and most of the Black people that I know, if not all of them, to be honest with you, I would say most of them grew up in a single parent home. My wife, you know, she grew up in Brooklyn. There was only one family that she knew of that had both parents in their home, and they were from Jamaica. You know, this is a cultural issue that we need to discuss, but we need to discuss it in a more common sense way, or at least identify why it's the case. I don't think it's just as simple as the welfare state. I think it's far deeper than that. I think there are elements of feminism that play a huge part in keeping the status quo or giving legitimacy to the reason our families look the way they do. We're no longer allowed to shame it. We're no longer allowed to shame anything, really. Everything is okay. But this reality of single parenthood is mediocre, and it provides mediocre results, and most of the time, semi-failing results, if not failing results. It is a huge contributing factor. The demoralization of men and the importance of fathers, you know, that is something that's real, that's happening within our country. And we need to talk about why men are important outside of providing money. We need to talk about what they provide for the children and lessons and our viewpoints and how we see the world and how we approach the world, how we protect children. I just wrote an article for Human Events talking about how single parenthood is actually a vulnerability, a safety vulnerability for children, because if you're a single mother raising a child, you can't be there 24/7. You have to go out and work most of the time. So which means you have to trust someone else to be around your child who has no real investment in them, like a biological parent. So that's the reality. You have to bring them to a daycare center and hope that nothing bad happens to them physically, or they're molested, or anything like that. Finding another relationship. If you're a single mother, you find a boyfriend who wants to move in. That increases the likeliness of something negative happening towards your children, including molestation. The statistics are just staggering when you start looking at those particular dynamics involving a non-biological figure into the home along with a child. So single parenthood is slowly destroying our society with crime, with children needing to take narcotics, or growing up to take narcotics, our drug epidemic, you name it. The commonality that you see is broken homes, single parenthood, even divorces in many cases. So we need to have a restoration of family and marriage and the importance of it.
Do you think that spirituality in the church plays a role in that?
Actually, yes, I left that out. I think that's a big one too. I think people see themselves as gods instead of seeing God himself. I think that we have become so self-consumed with ourselves and we don't sacrifice for anything, including God. I know Christians who put other things ahead of being a Christian. I know Black Americans who think being Black is more important than being a Christian. And that's not the order if you're actually a Christian. You don't have to be a Christian, but if you're going to be one, be one. Don't just claim to be one. That's been my viewpoint. When I questioned God, I didn't claim to be a Christian anymore. I became an agnostic. But when I found God and found my faith, I'm a Christian. And so that's always going to be my worldview. That's how I'm going to see people. Race is one thing that is just a characteristic. But deep down, I'm a human and I'm a child of God. And that's how I see other people. So I'm going to treat them accordingly. I'm going to call out the evil. I don't care what they look like. But I think we need to find God. We need to appreciate the role that God plays in our lives. And I truly believe he's capable in, or is playing a role in many of our lives. We just have to be willing to accept it.
Thank you for that. I want to go back to what you said about men, traditionally only acknowledged as a source of income for some reason. Like that's the only thing that men contribute to a family. And it mm-hmm. just brings to my mind that with this whole victim mentality that the leftist ideology is about, it also has the villains. And the villains are men, and the villains are heterosexuals. Anything that goes against that divisive, pitting men against women in feminism, heterosexual versus homosexual, disrupting the nuclear family, whatever that means to BLM and the neo-Marxists. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure if I mentioned this in the book, but a healthy father figure would never let their child see themselves as a victim. That's kind of how I see it. I think a healthy father figure is supposed to be real with their children, but not allow them to relish in mediocrity or seeing themselves as incapable. He's supposed to be encouraging. He's supposed to be their purpose compass, is what I'd like to call him. He's supposed to guide their children. And seeing yourself as a victim is stagnant. You don't go anywhere. You're just stuck in mud. Or if you're moving, you're moving very, very slow. And part of the book, when I say Black victim, the Black victor, is talking about me. When I saw myself at times as a victim, I didn't progress. Or I didn't progress fast enough. When I stopped pitying myself, when I stopped looking at myself as incapable or lacking, and also when I accepted God into my life and realized that he was doing things and looking out for me throughout my life, that's when all the blessings, all the things that, even sitting here talking to you is a blessing. All these things have come into place because I stopped my mindset and I accepted God in my life. And I stopped looking at people as holding me back, or even just looking at my childhood as holding me back. I use those things to empower myself and motivate me to do better, and actually motivate me to not continue to cycle for my son who's 16 years old. And so he knows my story. He's actually read my book, and he understands what I went through and why I see the world the way I do. And he's appreciative that his father cares about him a lot, deeply. And I've always been in his life. And I couldn't say the same thing. And I made it very important to not continue that cycle for him. So much in the way when I'm talking about Black people in a very abstract way, the book talks about me, my childhood, growing up with just my mom and my sister, and wishing my father was there to watch me play baseball, and looking at everybody else have their father. You know, those things stick out for me, and I think about those things. But at the same time, I don't want that to hold me back. I want that to empower me to do better. And so that's what I did. I became a better father than my father.
That's really important to share, because it's not just a self-help psychology lesson here. It's actual changing the structure of our society through family and through faith. So thank you for sharing that. Where can people go to get your book?
It's on Amazon. You can look for Black Victim and Black Victor on barnesandnoble.com. And you can also purchase it on wrongspeak.net, where they can read articles from really good writers, including myself occasionally. You can go to wrongspeak.net and purchase signed copies or non-signed copies as well.
Thank you so much, Adam B. Colin, for joining us today. Next, we're going to talk to Amelia Love. She is the author of How to Be Happy, as soon as we get back.
The iSat Phone 2 is the latest generation satellite phone designed for the most reliable commercial satellite communications network in the world. The iSat Phone 2 from Inmarsat is ready, reliable, and robust. iSat Phone 2 has fast network registration and unrivaled battery life with up to 160 hours of standby time. iSat Phone 2 operates over global geostationary satellites with 99% network availability and reliable call stability and network connection. Engineered to withstand the most extreme conditions, the iSat Phone 2 is dust, splash, and shock resistant. The iSat Phone 2 has built-in tracking and assistance buttons and gives notifications even when the antenna is stowed. And with the easy-to-use interface and high-visibility display, the iSat Phone 2 is ready to go. Find out more at Inmarsat.com.
Amelia Love is the author of How to Be Happy. Amelia, you have an interesting job, to be happy and teach others how to be happy. Tell us exactly what it is that you do.
So I have a coaching company, and I have lots of ladies that actually work for me, and then we actually expand out across the whole world. So we have ladies in Dubai, we have ladies in England, and then we have them in New York as well. So ladies all over the world. And what I've done is created a program that enables you to master your own inner shadow. There's many different words you can use for it, whether it's inner shadow, inner ego, inner demons, even if you want to be brave with it. It is actually possible to go in and master your mind through deep forgiveness, through education, and through building of community. And I just want to say as well, Adam, what a champion. What a champion. What an amazing man. I was fascinated by everything he said.
I think he was working with his inner shadows to be able to, you know, come to where he is for sure. You've got a course people can learn on a website. How does that work?
So there's a couple of things. If somebody would like to come in and do the really deep, advanced work, this is typically for women that are in a good space already, and they can actually come in and do an 8-week program and clear out a lot of the generational stuff, the childhood trauma, the adult woundings, those sort of things. So That is one option. Something else is there is a book called How to Be Happy. And Dr. Charlie Ward is actually one of the guests in the book. And it's under development right now. We're putting it all together. It's getting written. And people can pre-order that book. And we're actually going to give that away for free. So that should be ready in the next month or two. And at the back of that book will actually be a short course so that those that want to raise in frequency will be able to do that work, and that will help. And it will help them if they want to then go and step up to doing the more advanced work later.
Great. Well, I've heard you say that you help women. So who exactly do you specialize in helping?
So I want to be clear, if a man feels the calling and he's like, I want to do this, we will let him do the work. And if there's a woman under 35 that wants to do this and they're very mature and determined, committed, we'll say you can do it. But specifically, we really work with women over 35. They're normally in the US, some are in the UK, but again, they have been all around the world. They tend to be family orientated, but also career driven. They tend to be the most positive of their circle, which is what's interesting, because sometimes I meet people, they say, oh, you're a life coach. I have a friend that's in a bit of a car, you know, a bit of a car wreck, and maybe I'll send it to you. And I'm like, no, I'd rather have you. And that's because what we do is we take those ladies, they're at a kind of a 6-7, if naught is low and 10 is high, we take the 6-7s and we get them to 10 and we help them stay there. So typically the ladies are Christian conservative patriots, to be honest. That's who most of our clients are. And most of them are in their early 50s. So we have a lot of ladies in their 40s, some in their 60s, and we just had a lady come in her 70s. But that's roughly, it's like a good way of sort of seeing who it is that we work with. But I want people to know if they feel that calling. Like I said, I very much feel I work for God, and I want to help others. And some of our coaches are actually pastors. And so it's very much what we do is a little bit alternative, but our intentions are to help people to get closer to God and to heal and to feel happy permanently. And so, like I said, I'm from England. And so it does mean that I have a little bit of a different technique. I didn't grow up in the South in America. And so sometimes the way I explain things can sound a little strange, but that's why it's so excellent that I have the coaches that are pastors. And I have a CEO that's actually based in California as well, who goes to church twice a week, which is why, again, when Adam was speaking, I was like, I disagree wholeheartedly with everything, you know, building families, keeping families together, women having the self-worth, the self-love, the morality to build the life and the families that they want. All of that comes from a space of the decisions that we make. You see, oftentimes humans are self-sabotaging. And so if we can get rid of that little voice that's trying to direct you in the wrong direction, if we can quieten that down, if we can turn the volume down on that, what happens is the voice of God, your higher self and the voice of God that's coming through, that's guiding you to the most amazing things, you can hear it clearly. And so I do strongly feel that everybody on earth needs to do some deep forgiveness. Everybody on earth needs to do some cleansing, some healing, so that their frequency can come up. Because we are in a pivotal time in history right now. And the way that you experience what's going to happen in the near future is very much going to be dictated by your frequency. And your frequency will be your level of healing, because you will make decisions from that space. You will attract people from that space. You will repel people from that space. And so it's so important that people take the time now and understand that it's an inside job. You can't just pay somebody to do this for you. You have to do the hard work yourself. It's not going to happen just in a 20-minute course or a reading a quick book. It's not going to change. You have to make the decision that now is the time for you to do that work for yourself. But you see, the thing that's so important to me, Sean, is that if everyone understands that their individual responsibility for self and their individual well-being and spiritual hygiene, if they take care of that, then collectively this is going to affect everything for all of us. But you see, there's so many people that want. Yeah, everybody wants to put it on someone else. Oh, again, back to the victimhood. That's why it was just so beautiful the way everything fitted together with the two segments, because he's talking about victimhood. While you're in victimhood, you're like a plastic bottle being thrown around by the ocean. But once you do the inner work and you tune into your inner guidance system and you can hear God clearly, you're now like a boat with a sail and an engine. You can go where you want. You can do what you're supposed to do. You will do what you came down here to do. You will start feeling a level of fulfillment. You'll be in divine purpose. And, you know, so many of us came down here to be warriors and to serve and to help. And some are serving, but degrading themselves, as in degrading their energy, losing energy. They're pouring from an empty cup. A lot of the single mothers, for example, pouring from an empty cup, learning how to fill up that cup so that they can still serve and help others, but not burn out. And even women that are lucky enough to be in very happy, stable families with an amazing husband, they still sometimes overgive. And so it's learning the self-worth and the self-love so that you actually are able to look after yourself and to keep on giving. And so it's finding that perfect balance between self-love and service to others.
That makes sense to me. Can you tell me, I think that you met the founder of American Media Periscope, John Michael Chambers. What were the circumstances of that?
It was so fun. Oh my gosh. So Dr. Charlie Ward is a good friend of mine. And he had let me know that he was visiting America. And so I took a special trip to Nashville just to go meet with Charlie. And I did think I was going to an event, but I actually got the date wrong. So the event was the day before. Anyway, so we met for lunch. And at the lunch, he mentioned that he was going to be meeting with John in the evening. And he asked if I could come along. And we ended up having a very star-studded table. We had Juan O'Sullivan, as well as Kirk, as well as John and Charlie. And it was just so much fun. It was so, so much fun. There was such good energy at the table. And I was saying to them that what's so important now is we have lots of different leaders and teachers. But if we can come together, as we come together now, this is how we help to heal humanity. This is how we help to raise the frequency of the planet. Because as leaders and teachers that are very different come together, we're walking our walk and talking our talk and leading by example so that people in the world can see that it's time for us to now come together with people that are different from ourselves in whatever way that is.
Yeah, I'm with you there, you know, and I think Charlie and you and John and Amp, we're all putting our power together here for people to heal, for people to level up, and ultimately to heal our country and the world. So tell us, are there any other projects coming up besides the ones that you mentioned that you want to make sure you let us know about?
So again, you can pre-order the happiness book. The best place to go is just to the Amelia Love World website. You can see everything on there. I noticed you pop the things there. But you can pre-order the How to Be Happy book. And as soon as it's ready, it will be coming straight to you in your emails for free. If you're interested in talking to me or one of my coaches about actually doing the advanced work, you can do that at Amelia Love Academy. And then I also have a free affirmation track that you can find as well, and an hour's free training also on Amelia Love Academy. And I want everybody to understand, you know, forgiveness is one of the most misunderstood words. I say the other one is meek. The world will be inherited by the meek. Whereas meek means good. The world will be inherited by the good. So we're all super meek over here. but forgiveness is very misunderstood, because forgiveness does not mean that you are to let this person off the hook. It does not mean you're saying what they did was okay. It does not mean that you have to tell them that they're forgiven. And it certainly does not mean that you have to make friends or reconnect with them. So once you understand what forgiveness means, it means you're releasing yourself of pain that was given to you or created by someone else and brought into your life. And you are releasing it so that you no longer live in the past and you can live in the present. And in the present, it really is a present. Because in the present now, you can feel joy, you can feel happiness, and you can hear your intuition and you can hear God. And so forgiveness is such an important thing that we all have access to. But the really deep forgiveness, sometimes it's good to have someone hold your hand. It's a little bit like trying to cross the Sahara Desert. You can try and do it on your own, or you can try and do it with somebody who does it all day, every day.
It's easy for us to think that we've forgiven someone, but if you look deep inside, perhaps we're still holding on there. So it is good to get some guidance. Thank you for joining us, Amelia Love. You can get her free book coming up, pre-order it, How to Be Happy. Thank you for watching AmericanMediaPeriscope.com. We are America's Patriot-only network. Reach us at ampnews.us. You can get my breaking news updates at SeanMorganReport.com and follow me on Truth Social at SeanMorganReport. God bless all you patriots. Good night and good luck.